I want to mention two things before I begin. First of all, I was thinking, Yolanda was talking to me before the service about the whole legislative stuff that's going on with gay marriage. And one of the things that I'm aware of, and I mentioned this to Yolanda, is that Christians really shouldn't expect Christian behavior from non-Christians. And so when our country or, you know, our state goes in a direction that is not necessarily a Christian direction, it shouldn't be too surprising. On the other hand, as believers, we do have an opportunity to have a say in the direction of our country. And it occurred to me that I had wanted to encourage you, as long as the final vote hasn't been taken, that you can email your state senators, and it's not hard to get hold of them in this electronic age, and at least if whatever your opinion, voice that, and you know, whatever you think about what true marriage is, you have the opportunity as a Christian, as a citizen of the United States, to let your voice be heard. And I think if enough Christians actually did that in the next day or so before a vote's taken, it might make a difference. So I just would encourage you to think about that. Second thing I wanted to mention is I wanted just to say to those of you who are graduating how proud I am of the youth of our church. A couple weeks ago, there was an awards ceremony at Sleepy Hollow High School. And as I sat there as the pastor, I saw every single graduate of from our church, and even a few people like Marion, who wasn't a graduate, get awarded some significant awards for their achievements academically. And it was fun as a pastor to sit there and think, they're in our church. And I know John, and I know Carl, and I know Deanna, and Joanna, and Marion. And it was just great to see that we have such great kids here. And I'm proud of you guys. I just wanted you to know that. One of the things that some of you know, if you are regular attenders at the church, is that a few years ago, I announced to you all that I was going to try to write a book. And I've discovered that it's hard to write a book. It doesn't just happen by sitting down for an hour at a computer keyboard and then all of a sudden the book is finished. It takes a number of hours and days and weeks and sometimes months to put a book together. But I wanted to write a book, and it's still in the process. I haven't given up on it. It's a labor of love, a book about my dad. And the reason I wanted to write about my dad is because of the impact that his life has had, not only on my life, but on the lives of many other people. And I need to tell you right up front, he's not the most amazing dad in the world, but he's a pretty amazing man. You know, I could tell you about books that he's written, significant Christians he has influenced by their testimony. But I just want to mention what some of you already know, but about 25, 30 years ago, Newsweek magazine named my dad as one of the most influential preachers in the English-speaking world. And then a few years ago, maybe 5 years ago, Christianity Today had a similar article and named my dad as one of the most influential preachers in the 20th century. Now, I tell you that because it's kind of fun to brag on my dad. I have to say that. But I wanted to put this in context because my primary reason for wanting to write a book is not really, honestly, to brag on my father, but because over the course of my lifetime, I've learned a lot from his life. You see, my dad was a preacher. He started preaching when he was 14 years old at the rescue missions down in New York City. And though he's a preacher, he's really never been a pastor. He was an associate pastor when I was young, but he's never been a senior pastor of a church. His whole ministry has been spent in seminaries, teaching people how to preach. And so he's not a pastor, he's a teacher, a professor. And I explain that to you, especially those of you who don't know my father, so that you can understand what I want to tell you about him today. Because in addition to being a professor over the course of over 40 years in seminary instruction, he's also been a seminary president twice and has guided two different schools. And it's in the course of that background that I want to tell you a story that I learned about my dad. Now, this particular story I want to tell you today is not like any other that I have shared so far, as I've told you some of the chapters in this book. Till now, when I've told you some glimpses about my dad's life, I've told you stories that my dad has told me. This is not a story that my dad told me. In fact, interestingly enough, this is a story that I learned from Ken Ogletree. Because a few years ago, Ken said, you know, I was online and I looked up your dad online and I found this this blog about your dad, and you might be interested to read about it. So I looked it up, and there was this blog by a fellow by the name of Pastor Mike. I think the website was eternalperspectives.com, which is, I checked it out this week. It's no longer up. But I noted the story on the blog, and I wanted to tell you this story because I think it's one that is really an appropriate story for us on Father's Day. Not only because it's about my father, but because I think there are lessons in it, important lessons that we can learn. Now, I learned as I perused this blog that this fellow, Pastor Mike, and I had several things in common. In fact, I was really surprised because as far as I know, I have never met this fellow, Mike, but we really had a few different things that our paths probably should have crossed. Whether they did or not, I don't think they did. But for one, Mike went to the same church that I went to in Dallas. Now, it was a fairly large church, and I'm not exactly sure the chronology. He doesn't spell out when he was there. But he was at this church, Believer's Chapel, and it was at that church that he had heard my father speak. Now, again, my father wasn't a pastor. He was just a seminary professor. But he came in to speak at Believer's Chapel on occasion. And that's where Mike heard about my dad and heard him preach. So I discovered that this blog writer, Mike, and I had one thing in common. We came from the same church, even though, as far as I know, I had not met him. Second thing I discovered, which I thought was also very interesting, is that Mike and I graduated from the same seminary, which I thought was rather coincidental when you think that we both went to the same church in Dallas, and the seminary I graduated from was in Denver, Colorado. So somehow he ended up leaving Dallas and going to Denver and graduating from Denver Seminary, and that's what happened to me. So I found that rather interesting as I read his blog. But there was a third thing, and this was the reason that Ken sent me the blog and why I was most interested in it, and that is that this fellow Mike was a big fan of my father's. In fact, that's really why he left Dallas to go to Denver, because my dad had been teaching at Dallas Seminary for like 19 years, and then he left to become president of Denver Seminary. And when Mike decided to go to seminary, he was going to major not in preaching, but in counseling. And Denver had a very good counseling program. And he thought, well, if Haddon Robinson is the president of the school, I can go and get a counseling degree and come under his influence. And so, again, according to the blog, that was his plan. So he moved from Dallas, went to Denver. I found it interesting as I read through the blog that this guy who went to Denver, in part because he wanted to come under my father's influence, said that in 3 years of seminary, he only had one conversation with my father. Now, I don't know why he didn't have more. I would think if I made a trek of 1,000 miles or so to go to a school because of one person, I'd want to spend more time with him. But he said he had one conversation, but he said that conversation influenced his entire life. And that's really what this story is about, that one conversation. And you know, when you think about it, can you think in your life about one conversation that changed your life? Maybe some of you who are married can think about it, because there was that conversation where somebody said, "Will you?" And you said, "I do." And all of a sudden everything was changed from that. But even that, really, most of the time, was preceded by a few other conversations that you didn't just jump into it in one conversation. Really, when I think about it, seldom does one encounter with somebody shape your life. And that's true of all of us. It's certainly true for us as parents. And on Father's Day, that's worth noting, that, you know, you would like to think that I could, as a dad, sit down with my sons and have just one heart-to-heart conversation with them and say, "This is what you need to know in life, and if you follow this, you're going to be right on, and you're going to live successfully, and it's going to be great." And you have that conversation when they're 3 years old, and you're done. You know, they're on their way. It doesn't work that way. Now, as parents, you know that the way you influence your children is not in just one grandiose conversation. It's and all kinds of little conversations and talks and instruction and discipline. It takes place not in a half hour or half a year. It takes place at least in a half a lifetime as you talk to them. That's why Moses in Deuteronomy, if you remember, in Deuteronomy chapter 5, Moses gave, he's actually preaching a sermon. I don't know if you realize that, but Deuteronomy is just a collection of sermons that Moses preaches. And in chapter 5, he reiterates the Ten Commandments, reminds the people of the commands that God has given. And then in chapter 6, referring back to these commands, these instructions from God, he says in verses 4 through 9, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands. Bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates." What Moses was trying to say in that passage is the way that you influence your children, the way you teach your children, is in the little, frequently repeated lessons that happen again and again and again over time. You know, in the morning when they wake up and you remind them of certain things, and in the afternoon when you sit down maybe and have lunch, or when they're playing as little toddlers, or maybe when they're a little bit older, when they come home from school and they come home and you need to tell them something and you remind them. And you realize as a parent, I must have told them 1,000 times. And you wonder if it will ever stick. One of the lessons that I picked up from my mom is one that I think about frequently. In fact, I probably say it more often than my mom ever said it to me. And that is that where there are no options, there are no problems. I use that all the time when things, you know, you kind of get in one of these situations and it's a bad situation, but you really don't have any choices. You just have to go through it. And rather than get all upset about being in a bad situation, I think about these words that my mom said to me. I think, well, where there are no options, there are no problems. And I just kind of plow through it. Within the last year or so, I remember talking to my mom. In fact, I remember saying that in our kitchen. And my mom said, where did you get that? And I said, what do you mean, where did I get that? I got it from you, Mom. I mean, you must have said that 100 times when I was growing up. She said, really? I said, I don't remember saying that. So you did, and now I say it all the time. But that's how it is. Sometimes it's intentional. Sometimes it's stuff that we want to make sure that our kids don't miss. And so we remind them and we make sure that they know it and they hear it again and again. But sometimes it's those things that are kind of in our souls that just overflow and we just say it because we believe it. And that's the stuff that sticks with our kids. You know, you find children who grow up going to church, and when they get older and they go off to college and they graduate from college, their lives kind of take a different direction. They've been told what to believe by their parents. They've heard it in church. But sometimes, the only place they really were hearing it was in church. I mean, at home, there really wasn't a whole lot of tie-in between the faith that was professed on Sunday and what was practiced by the parents Monday through Saturday. And so when you think about it, when a child hears maybe once a week, this is how you're supposed to live, but they see 6-7 days a week, this is how you're supposed to live, it's not all that surprising that they follow what they hear the most of. Moses is simply saying to us as parents, if you want your children to know the morality of God, if you want to have the heart of God impressed upon your children, when they get up in the morning, when they're eating with you, when they're walking with you, when you're talking with them, when you're tucking them into bed, you talk about these things. And over time, they're impressed with the message. You know it, if you have toddlers, you don't just have one conversation with them at the street corner saying, don't you go out in the street. I don't want to see you stepping in front of a car. You have to stop them. You may even have to discipline them, but you tell them as often as they need to know that they're not supposed to cross the street, and you repeat it and you stop them and you make sure they understand that. And if you're a responsible parent, even then, you still keep them within eyesight. Those of you who have teenagers, have you had that conversation about sex with your kids? Hopefully it wasn't a conversation. I mean, if you have just a conversation so they know the facts of life and they know your morals, that may make a difference, but seldom does one conversation really make a difference. I mean, it's very uncomfortable to talk to your kids about sex, but if you don't talk to them about what they're doing in their date life and how they're handling it and whether they're having success, and I mean, it's their choice. They're going to choose, but if you don't help them by repeating it, how are they ever going to learn? What Moses is saying is that seldom does one conversation do it. It's a lifetime pattern, consistently telling your kids. Now, I say that because, getting back to my story, I found it interesting that this one conversation that this seminary student had with my dad was, according to him, life-changing. So I found myself wondering, what was it that took place in this conversation that caused Mike to kind of reflect back on that and see a life-changing, life-course-altering event. Well, the conversation took place in my dad's office as president of the school. Mike confessed in the blog that he really had an attitude problem. He had a professor, in fact, there's another thing we shared in common. I had this same professor by the name of Donald Burdick. He was a New Testament professor, a Greek professor at Denver Seminary. And I don't know what Mike's theological convictions were, but for some reason he felt that in class, Dr. Burdick did not represent his views very well. He felt that that Dr. Burdick didn't respect his views. And he would sit in class and just fume to himself that Dr. Burdick just doesn't know what he's talking about. And he shouldn't be teaching. And finally, it just overflowed, and he decided, I'm taking this to the top. So he set up an appointment with the president of the school, my dad. And that was the conversation that I want to tell you about. You see, Mike came into the office, and he began to unload with my father. It was a very short conversation, quite honestly. He began to explain to my dad how Dr. Burdick doesn't seem to have any respect for Mike's particular viewpoint. And he fumed and ranted for a little bit. And then my father stopped him and said, "Now, I suppose you know that Don's wife, Violet, has Alzheimer's disease." Mike said, I didn't know that. It was the first time he'd ever heard of it. But I said, Donald is committed to his wife. I don't know anyone who is as committed to his spouse as Don is. He gets up in the morning, and every morning he has to bathe her and get her dressed, help her brush her teeth, help her brush her hair. Everything she needs done, he has to help her do. And then he goes off to teach at the seminary. Between classes, he comes back home and he checks on her to make sure she's doing well. And he's determined that he's not going to have an aide or a nurse do anything that he could do for Violet. My dad said to Mike, said, "I had a conversation with Dr. Burdick a while back. And I asked him, how is it that you are able to carry on a full-time load teaching at a seminary and still give such meticulous care to your wife? Isn't it a burden? Isn't it overwhelming?" Dr. Burdick said, with tears welling up in his eyes, he said, "Caring for Violet is not a burden. It's a privilege." As my dad explained this to Mike, sitting across the desk from him, the phone rang. Mike said it was as if it was on cue. My dad picked up the phone and talked for a few minutes, and as he was talking, he kind of put down the phone. He said, we're done here, aren't we?" And Mike said, "Yeah, we were done." He said, I walked out of that meeting and everything had changed. I'd come in having one perspective about Dr. Burdick, and I left having not just a different perspective about him, but about people, about marriage. He said, from that point on, everything began to change. When I would go to class, I didn't see Dr. Burdick as some sort of antagonist in the classroom. He was a fellow struggler, just a human being, trying to fulfill his marriage commitment. And I realized that there was so much more I could learn from my professor than just New Testament or Greek. With that conversation, he said, everything changed. This is how his blog ended. I jotted it down. I will probably never have the opportunity to talk to Haddon and tell him the impact he has had and continues to have on my life. But were such a time to become available to me once again, I would seize the chance to simply tell him, thanks. Thanks, Haddon, for teaching me how to think about God, about His Word, about His people, for continually and faithfully demonstrating a commitment to the Bible and people born out of your writings and sermons. Thanks for providing a living example of how great genius and tenderness can be melded together. And thanks especially for teaching me that Christianity is not primarily about ideas, concepts, and truths, but it is truly about relationships with God and people, about grace and compassion, about being and not just thinking. As I read Mike's blog, I thought, it's great to be Haddon Robinson's son. I was really proud of my dad. But I have to tell you, I also thought, Mike gives my dad way, way too much credit. I mean, there is no question that this conversation had made a difference. I mean, that's what he was writing about. And I realized that this conversation had made a difference for at least two reasons. Mike focused on one, and I think he managed to either overlook or just not mention the other. I mean, the one clear thing that he noted was that the way that my father handled that situation caused it to have a lasting impact on him. I mean, there are lots of different ways that he could have dealt with this disgruntled student. He could have just said, I don't meet with complainers. We're not going to have this meeting. We're not going to have this conversation. And perhaps in a seminary environment, that might be appropriate. You know, you don't need in Christian circles to coddle the complainers. But that's obviously not what my dad did. Or when he had Mike in front of him, he could have said, now Mike, you have an attitude problem. And before I hear anything about your concerns, we need to talk about your attitude, okay? And he could have confronted him, rebuked him. I mean, all that probably would have been merited. But he didn't do that either. Instead, he had the wisdom to see behind the complaint, to see this false view that Mike seemed to have about his professor, this failure to see him as another Christian, another human being. The writer of Proverbs in Proverbs chapter 15 has some great wisdom you're familiar with. He says this, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh answer stirs up anger. I think what Mike realized and what my dad did right in that situation was he responded with a gentle word. He didn't swat a fly with a sledgehammer. He just used a fly swatter. And that made a difference. And for those of us who are moms and dads, even those who are teachers, there's a lot to be learned about that. Because it's not just what we say that matters, it's how we say it. The attitude which we approach the situation. You know how it is. You have one of those horrible, rotten, no good days, and your child comes home and manages to push all the buttons, and they ask a question, and you have a choice at that moment. Are you going to explode and just rip into them, or are you going to step back, take a breath, and give a gentle answer? The difference may well be the difference as to whether you get your point across or whether they turn you off. My dad gets credit. He used the gentle approach. He chose his words carefully. But for this conversation to change Mike's life, I realized it was more than something my dad did. In fact, I would say the primary change wasn't because of something brilliant that my dad did. I think Mike gave my dad far too much credit. What made the difference was Mike's attitude. He came in apparently genuinely willing to listen and to learn. I mean, it's very easy to go into those circumstances, especially when you're angry with somebody and you've got your mind made up, you know how it is, no one's going to talk you out of it, you just want to be angry and you want somebody to justify your anger, and if they don't justify it, then you get angry at them. But apparently that's not what happened with Mike. No, when my dad told him this story about Dr. Burdick, it made a difference. He received it and embraced it enthusiastically. Again, the writer of Proverbs tells us back in chapter 13 in verse 1, he says, "A wise son heeds his father's instruction, but a mocker does not listen to rebuke." My dad gets credit in this blog for being some sort of super genius. He just had a good answer to somebody who had a receptive spirit, to a wise student. I realize, and some of you as parents realize, the great benefit that comes from having wise kids. Sue and I have thanked God many times, and I'm thankful with Carrie and Carl here, that God has given us wise boys. I was thinking this morning, I was telling Sue this morning, I realize that this morning is a rare occasion from now on that I'll have both sons together here in church to preach to. They're heading off in different directions. Carrie's already off in Illinois. It's a rare thing to have them here. But by God's grace, He's given them both wisdom, so that when we have said things to them, not always on the first conversation, but it's taken root in their lives, and they're living well. And a wise son, a wise daughter, a wise person accepts instruction, embraces the word, and allows it to change them. I realized that what my dad did in that conversation in his office over a quarter century ago was simply, in gentleness, plant a good seed in Mike's life. My guess is, at best, my dad maybe thought, you know, if I plant a good seed, maybe a little flower will grow. But in the soil of Mike's life, he planted this little seed and a garden burst forth. hey, he learned things about human beings and about Dr. Burdick and about marriage. I mean, I don't think, I've asked my dad about this incident, and it's kind of a fuzzy incident in his mind. That too is kind of interesting because, you know, sometimes it's not the conversations that we think that will make a difference that make a difference. Sometimes it's those other conversations. But if you want to have the possibility of a conversation, a short conversation that can have lasting results, you need somebody who chooses his or her words wisely and well. And you need somebody who's listening, who's really, really listening, ready to receive it and embrace it and live it. And I realize that in some ways, what happens in our families and our lives is what happens in our relationship with God. You know, you read through the whole Bible and you discover that God clearly gave his revelation to the people in the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments, as we said. He had Moses teach them. He had other leaders come along and lead, and he had prophet after prophet after prophet remind them of these words and tell them, if you don't follow this, there are consequences. And you know how it is. They weren't very receptive, were they? And last of all, in the New Testament, it said, God sent his Son. Jesus came, and he was the ultimate expression of love and grace and gentleness. Because he was the very expression of God, and he came, and he revealed what God was like, and he not only taught and exemplified what God was like, but then in his love for us, he died on a cross to pay for all of the failings and all the shortcomings that we have, all the things we've done wrong. And he said, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by me. I mean, what could be a better, more important, more significant answer to our problems than that? But you know as well as I do that that's in and of itself as incredible as what God did in response to our need. It still required something. It required a response on our part. We had to embrace it and accept it and believe it for it to make a difference. And that could be where you are today. Maybe you've heard that message your whole life. It's not enough just to hear it. No matter how well it's been presented or who it's been presented by, there still has to be that decision on your part. I'm going to learn. I'm going to live. I'm going to believe. And you trust what Christ has done for you. So whether you're here as a seeker or you're here as a parent, it's possible that one service, one conversation, one instance could change your life. It requires well-chosen words. If you're a parent, it means think about what you say before you say it to your kids. Fathers, recognize that we have the potential to shape our children, even in one conversation. So try to think before you speak. And sons and daughters and children, your response is crucial. You're going to receive and embrace wisdom. You never know where it'll come from. It could be from your dad. It could be from your mom. It could be from a teacher. It could be from a boss. Who knows? It might even come from a pastor. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for the awesome opportunity of being a father. It is bigger than I have managed at times, greater than I am able to live. But I thank you that through your Son, you help me live it out every day. Father, I pray you would help us to learn the wisdom of the story. We'd be wise enough to choose our words carefully and wise enough to respond when wisdom calls and embrace it. Thank you for telling us again and again and again how much you love us and what you want us to do with our lives. We thank you and praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.